About an hour outside of Pretoria, you'll find a small town called Bronkhorstspruit. And there you'll find the Nanhua Temple. It is considered the largest Buddhist temple and seminary in Africa. It is a vast complex that covers about 2.5 square kilometers, and men between 18 and 35 can go and live there and be taught Buddhist spiritual practices free of charge. And its presence, as odd as it is, isn't necessarily surprising. I mean, Buddhism as a belief is well known throughout the world, and its presence is well established in popular culture and especially in the alternative health industry. But the thing is, the way the Chinese have packaged Buddhism is that whether it was intentional or not, it makes it seem very synonymous with Chinese culture itself. This is despite the fact that Buddhism does not actually originate from China, but from India. Yet, if you picture a Buddhist monk, you are most likely going to imagine a person of Chinese descent. In many ways, this speaks to the power of culture, and specifically spiritual culture, as a driving force in how a nation builds its own identity, even if the elements of that structure do not originally belong to that particular nation. On the other hand, we as South Africans are very keenly aware that our culture is slowly disappearing. Yet, at the same time, there has been a resurgence of interest in African spirituality. The number of people who are becoming Isangoma has exploded, and every other month there seems to be another TV show that deals with Ubungoma or spirituality. But my question is this. So what? So what that everyone knows someone who has been to a pilgrim, or that there is Indumba at just about every street in the hood? So what? What will all of that do for us as a people? Will it help in the surging rate of unemployment? Will it reduce the number of high school dropouts that we have? Will it reduce the number of black women and young girls who are abused and raped, and whose bodies litter shallow graves on the outskirts of our collective psyche? What will the death of our culture actually mean? Is our culture even relevant at all? To try to unpack this complex issue, I went to speak to Professor Pitika Ntuli. Born in 1942 in Springs, Johannesburg, Professor Ntuli is a sculptor, a poet, a writer, and an academic who spent 32 years of his life living in exile in the UK and in Swaziland. He holds an MFA from the Pratt Institute in New York and an MA in Comparative Industrial Relations and Industrial Psychology. While in exile, he taught at numerous institutions, and he's also a healer and an expert in African indigenous knowledge systems. I'm hoping that he will be able to give insights on how we create our culture and how our culture creates us.
Culture in itself, as we'll talk, as we talk, you know, is dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe we could just shit on and
okay.
Get to it.
All right. So to start off with, you were born in Springs, according to the bio that I was reading. And you went into exile in 78.
63.
63. You went to Swaziland. Yes. Is that when you went to Swaziland?
Yeah, 63. 78 is when I was in detention in the death cells in Swaziland before going to London.
Mm. What were you what were you charged with?
Treason. You remember there was a secret Bethel trial of Zephon Tupin.
Yes.
Of Zephon Tupin, who was accused of leading a thing causing the Soweto uprisings and so on. There were 18 people. It was the longest trial in South Africa, held in Bethal, to keep the international media away. Because anything that had to do with, you know, blackness. Look at Sobukwe. Sobukwe was isolated totally. Biko has to be so brutally, you know, murdered. Anything that is actually, you know, black was suppressed. Why is it? It is because the culture that those people actually had posed such a danger to the colonizers and to the apartheid regime, basically. Well, let me put it this way. My father was a priest. His brother was a Sanusi, more than a Sangom. So culturally, you can see that I come with a twin approach, you know, to these things. So what then happened, my father and his brother, the Sanusi asked the priest that, have you ever seen a snake traveling with his family? The priest said, no. He said, when we are here, this side of it, our totem is a mamba snake. And yet you behave contrary to your culture. You want to take your children to Christianity, to whiteness, and you're abandoning your culture. So what I suggest then is that you give me one of your seven sons, that little naughty one, that during the holidays, he is with me. And then during school time, he is with you. When he grows up, he will then tell us as to whose culture he is going to adopt. Right? So in the process of being spending time with my uncle, I wasn't aware that I was actually being initiated culturally into becoming a Sangom, which ultimately ended up where these artworks are from. My graduation was to be taken in front of a tree, a dead tree, where he said, don't stand, sit there. Don't stand up until that tree speaks to you. Now, I'm about 18. How can a tree speak to me? After an hour, I'm sitting. When I look, he says, hey, forward. I realized that we could be spending days there. I knew this guy. If I don't find a way of letting the tree speak to me. Then in the end, I looked at the tree. I said, if this tree is to speak to me, how would it look like when it speaks to me? I began now imagining people inside that tree. When I looked at the branches became arms. I said, Viva! Because I was in politics. So he said, oh, the tree has spoken to you. But what happened here today, you will never understand it. If we are clever enough, you'll understand it 50 years from now. I just laughed, went away. It took me 55 years. To understand after reading, researching, and I accidentally stumbled upon it to say what you are saying to me, when you approach a tree like that, get rid of all knowledge you have. Go with a blank slate. If I knew nothing about anything and you told me the tree was going to speak to me, then I would believe you that the tree was going to speak to me. I would listen, I would hear the tree. Which is a basic philosophy from Eastern philosophy or anywhere, empty your mind. But let's come over to the issues of culture and colonialism. Colonial discourse thrives by just one thing. What colonialists have to do is to paralyze the culture of a people if they have to effect a total domination. The word culture in my language is isiko, ambasiko, sikelela, those supports. That way of life that actually, you know, supports you and makes you make up your decision. Culture involves science, philosophy. It involves education. It involves practically everything that actually exists. That constitutes what culture really is. So what then the colonialists wanted to do was to empty our minds so that we then start adopting their way of life. Take their names, practice them, take their religion, do anything. Only then they can be able to control you absolutely thoroughly on their own terms.
How does the process, can you specify how the process of emptying a person's mind works?
Now, yeah, you've got your own history. They come in here, they give you an alternative history, not the history that you yourself have. You've got your religious belief systems. And they get rid of your religious belief systems in order to impose their things. If you accept Christianity, you reject to a very large measure your sense of Africanness, your sense of spirituality, the sense of your ancestors, the sense of your old spirit. That's the process by which they do. So initially, what the colonialists wanted to do is to get the resources of a particular country. To do that, they sent in an army to subdue you. Then they sent in the missionaries and educators to educate you, to translate the Bible into your language, so that you accept what they are going to say on their terms, not on your or your own terms. So basically, therefore, you are in a situation in which, let me give you this. In African culture, when a child is born, you don't cut the umbilical cord. You leave the child with the umbilical cord. The child will crawl and move around with that umbilical cord in here. But where that umbilical cord drops, you plant a tree to create a link between that human being and a tree. And then we are going to pick up an animal as a totem. I am so busy. I'm the master of the hyena. I'm Hlogo yemama. So in other words, the interconnectedness of human life, plant life, animal life, the life of mountains, they are all interrelated in African culture. In African religion, because even African religion involves philosophy, it involves science, it involves everything. It's not just a neat Christian facility that you are going to find. So that's then where the issue of interconnectedness. When we say Ubuntu, right? If we are going to do this thing, isivusumuzi, that means you are doing it according to the belief systems of Vusumuzi, isn't it? When we are doing this thing, isintuli, that means you are doing it the Ntuli way. That means Ntuli is their way of doing it. When you are doing it isintu, what is this Ntu according to which you are doing it? That Ntu, there at the end of Ubuntu, for an instance, it's a Bantu stem which refers to the vital force, the power to cause things to happen and to change. That's what that Ntu means. You put in a mu in front of Ntu, what do you get?
Muntu.
Then how do you define Muntu? Ubuntu is one who possesses the power to cause things to happen and to change. Therefore, Ubuntu is a change agency. And yet colonialism wants to change you to be who they want you to be, not what you yourself want yourself to to be. Does that make sense?
Not really. But now there's a controversial point that comes up when we talk about colonialism and the impact of on black people or what actually happened to black people, especially if you want to talk about it in the spiritual sense of the life force and whatever and such aspects. And that is, how did we let colonialism happen if we had such a deep understanding of spirituality and the forces of nature and life and, you know, those powerful aspects of being, yet this still happened to us almost as if we unstopped, basically?
No, it is because of our culture. I mean, our culture is a very open, accommodating culture, right? Currently, I've got an exhibition called Azibuyele Ema Sisweni, right? What is Uxisa? If you come from Malawi, you come to my village, and then you ask for water, you are a foreigner. We don't ask you where you come from, whatever else it is. We give you food, give you a place to sleep. We don't even ask you, when are you leaving? If you are there after 3 weeks, we give you your own home and anything. You come and work with us. When you realize that you are going to stay here, we must get you a boyfriend or a girlfriend. We give you a cow. That is your cow, where you can get your milk. But when that cow gives birth to a calf, then you return that calf over to us. That's why they say Zibuyela Ema Sisweni. You are there accommodating other people. So in that spirit, we accommodated actually the Westerners, who had their own intentions on us. Violated our kindness, our openness. So that's where the issue of colonialism steeps through. And now, Western culture and colonialism had prisons and all of these things. Were there any prisons in Africa?
Mm-mm.
No. You had no prisons, because isolating somebody and punishing somebody there, it's not just that individual. You don't look at the individual as Vusi in here. That's why me, I am Pitika Gantuli Gamsalela Gamsalela Gaganomashigila or Pemba Gamakanda Matota. My whole history of my own people is mentioned, because I belong to the rest of these people. If you judge me according to how those people who came before me had behaved. You look at those huge sculptures there of Cetshwayo. The two figures that were in there were two Ntuli generals who defeated the British in 1879, the two brothers who led the Zulu wars and an army to defeat those people. So then you need then to understand, culture simply as something that covers up your own cosmology. How do you answer the world questions? It answers axiology. How do you judge morality, ethics, and all of those things are contained within that culture. Now, the people who colonized us came there with a mentality of a Newtonian physics of binary opposites, black, white. You are white, you are good. You are black, you are bad. Binaries. Everything was subjected to the brain and not to the heart, to the spirit, or to anything else. Everything has to do with the brain. It was a mechanical way of looking at it. Head office, head lights, head mistress, head teacher, head policeman, head this, geared for change. All the mechanical stuff that denies the existence of spirit. Right? Earlier on, I said, when a child is born, they link with the plants, they link with anything. We are talking here about the interconnectedness, the interrelationship, and the interdependence of everything else. We are talking quantum physics, which is in line with indigenous African knowledge systems.
True. So now, when you were then physically disconnected from the continent, how did you keep this connection alive for yourself?
Exile is a double consciousness, that's what I said. A double consciousness. You are conscious of who you are, where you come from, where you want to go back to. So you cannot forget your own culture, because your aim is to get back to your own culture. You are there actually in exile, fighting the people who came and disrupted you, so that they should leave you alone to go back there to re-establish your own progress according to your own terms. There is not one modernity, as we are told. There are many modernities. Chinese modernities, they follow their own trend. I mean, the Chinese, they don't believe in nation states like we believe in nation states in Africa. They believe in a civilizational state, which is what Nkrumah and the people who came in Africa before wanted: one Africa, one language, one currency, one African high command linked by culture. So,
but whose culture though?
Eh?
Whose culture?
What do you mean, whose culture?
This is precisely my dilemma, in that we talk about culture as this overarching culture, homogenous...
Is a, culture is an overarching thing. You can speak of a Nguni culture.
Mm-hmm.
The Nguni culture is going to be the culture of the Swazis, of the Ndebele, of the Xhosa, of the Zulu, because they all came from the same branch, family.
Yeah.
They do the things that they do that marks them. They suit to culture.
Hmm.
But you can find that the Sotho culture and the Nguni culture, the African cultures, they link.
Inevitably.
Yeah, if you read Sheikh Anta Diop, The Cultural Unity of Africa, then you are going to get that. The same Anta Diop who wrote African Origins of Civilization, Myth or Reality. So in other words, when we talk about Africa, we are talking whether you are in Ghana or Senegal, ancestors come first amongst anything. You got ancestors, you deal with them, you don't worship the ancestors.
Mm.
The ancestors are intermediaries between you and the higher spiritual being that is a creator whose name we don't know. Can you call your father by his name?
No.
Can you call your mother by his name?
Never.
Can you call an older person by his name? He said, yeah, Cyril.
No.
You can't. Now, how can we even claim that we know even God's name when we can't even call his name? Nkulunkulu means the big one. Mledzegamye, the one with one leg. Mudimu, the one who's upstairs. It cannot be a name of anybody.
So it's more of a description than a name.
It's more of a description rather than...
like Umvelinqangi.
Yeah. So, you do that. So the question then you had asked earlier on is that if you leave your country in exile, whose culture do you leave? What you do is that you interpret the culture where you are according to your own culture. You can do things according to how they want them to do if you want to get along.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, your sense of being, your sense of self remains. Mm. What makes it you to survive? I mean, I've been in exile for 33 years in exile. I still write and perform poetry in 9 of our official languages that express our own kind of a culture. It is the strength of the culture that I carried with me that made me survive. That's why we've got exiles and insiles. Maybe we are an insile.
Hey, what man. Does that sound like an insult?
Inside, yeah, you see, it is an inside. Hey, man, brother, man, way back in America, man, things ain't gonna be that bad, man. This guy has never been outside of Johannesburg, but he's just speaking like he is in Wisconsin or anywhere or somewhere far away,
yeah.
Because what they have done is that they already are interpolated or co-opted into a foreign culture.
Mm-hmm.
That you are. We are so vusibuzi, so lost that we don't even culturally understand our own languages. What is life in your language?
Impilo.
Now, how do you spell impilo?
I-M-P-I-L-O.
Remove LO. What remains?
Imp. War.
What is knowledge?
Ulwaz.
Remove Z at the end. What remains?
Ulwa.
Ulwa, ulwa. Knowledge is that which you must fight for.
Is it?
Right? Impilo. It's,
so life is war.
Yeah, impilo is war. You have got a phone. Me nang in a phone gazi. That gazi in my phone speaks about the awesomeness of my phone. Better than yours. At home, you know, kosi?
Gaz.
No daughter?
Gaz.
No malume?
Gaz.
And then we look at the word umfazi, woman, constructed of two of the most powerful concepts in the world, the concept of knowledge and the concept of death. Then we end up with a stupid concept that the man is the head of the family, which is not culturally an African thing. It is a Christian, it is a Christian thing.
Is it?
Yes.
Because many people believe that.
No.
That is as African as you can get.
No, it's not. It's not. Africa had its own divisions of a labor without any...
Are we a matriarchal society?
Any hierarchy. A lot of matriarchal in the society. Are you aware that there's no king that does not have Indlovukazi? Indlovukazi is a mother to the king. Right?
Yes.
There must always be the mother to the king. Because a person who does not respect the mother cannot be respected by other people.
And now that you mention it, it's rare to hear about the father of the king.
No. It's the queen mother. That is it. That's, guarded spiritual, matriarchal power that holds, people, hold African, people, together.
Mm.
If I think in my language, when I was in London, I was not thinking in English. I was thinking in my language. That's why I can say impilo. I can say this. Let me give you another example. In Zulu, I've got a mask, right? Yinye. Mm. I add another one. Zingazimbili. I add another one. Zintatu. I add another one, zine. I add another one, shanu. Then I'm wrong. I'm no longer adding. Shanu is shanu gela, 10 things inside out. 6 was alama tupa, you yourself. 7 kumbisa. 5, 6, 7 you symbolize. 8 shia kalumbili, -2. 9 -1. 10 you resolve. Before you get to 10, you add, you symbolize, you subtract. That's what the power of African culture. Heeded and guided, actually, in language. It is so powerful and so formidable.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know what you're dealing with. You're dealing with Africans. And you're dealing... and you're dealing with culture. Now, let's take it this way. When, for instance, what's this other example I wanted to give? But I think it will come. Let's get back and recap. Culture is a way of life. The support that is given culturally. Language is very central to it, because it articulates the religion, the philosophy, and practically everything that goes in it. When in our government in here, we've got a Chapter 9 institution called Commission for the Protection and the Promotion of the Rights of Cultural, Religious and Linguistic, CRL. In a commission. The founders, fathers and mothers of this country put that Chapter 9 institution in order that we must not abandon our culture, we must guard our culture. That's why every week I was in one day right now looking at gender-based violence, to look at it from a cultural perspective, that is it possible that you could have gender-based violence in the real African cultural things. When people go to Ntabeni, Abakweta, What are they going to do there? Are they going to have their wheelies cut? Circumcision is just a part of a ritual where we are being taught your language, you are being taught your culture, you are being taught your belief systems, you are being taught your history.
Because now people are saying that that's where young boys learn violence.
Yeah, no, because that's what their interpretation, that is their interpretation.
Mm.
Now, if you look at it this way, who is Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture now?
Nothing there.
No. Yeah, that's right. We don't have it. Wait. Transport?
Razmatez.
Eh? I'm trying to remember this
short. Sigile Mbalula.
Mbalula.
Yeah.
Mbalula had to end up going for initiation. As long as you've never been circumcised, you are a boy. Go to the mountain and be a man. You are a boy. You can't get married if you have not been in there traditionally. Because there, they are saying, now you are ready to be a man. You are ready to take up a wife. You are ready to bring up children. You are a sane, good people within the culture. You are respected.
Now you're bringing back a very important point that I want to ask. About, does culture evolve or does culture die? Right, and the reason I say that is because that practice that you're talking about is very much declining and is now sort of reserved for some parts of mostly the Eastern Cape.
No.
Right, but I mean, by and large, not a lot of people go through that process. And now, what I want to understand that does it, the fact that a lot of men are not going through that process anymore, does it mean that the culture has died, or does it mean that there is a new culture of not doing that anymore?
No. The culture is there. I mean, Gwandebele, Bapedi, they do these things better. In the Eastern Cape, you got charlatans now that emerge for businesses are unrecognized, even by Inkumkani around there. Mm. They are just doing their own. They are doing their own things. So, KwaZulu Natal, the initiations were cancelled by Shaka, because Shaka says, if these people are in there and they are still in pain and there's a war comes, what's going to happen? That's why it was replaced by Amabuto, where you gather, you know, men together and women together, and initiate them together. With women, you've got what you call Amatrigiza, where older women mentor younger women as to how it is to be a woman, how to behave towards men and people and everything. So the whole of the culture is there. The need for initiation is so primal in every culture. In others, if at all you have not stabbed a person with your knife, we are not yet a man. Others are going to do bungee jumping on a mountain. Yeah! Everyone wants to be initiated, actually, into
something.
Yeah, into something. So African ways, therefore, of it is not just an incidental thing going over to a mountain. It's far much more nuanced and far much more diverse. Mm-hmm. It gets into your education, into your religion, into your philosophy, into everything that is part and parcel of life. That you are living, mm-hmm. You see, and then when you look at the issue of traditional healers, that's where again spirituality resides. In indigenous African knowledge system, every king or chief or nuna must have a traditional healer who's going to guide them and also to help them spiritually
as an advisor.
Yeah, as an advisor. That spiritual essence of it, guides you. Because spirit, you can't live without spirit. You can't live without breathing. That's how it is. What is spirit? It's umoya. What is breath? Umoya. It's just part and parcel of something you cannot get rid of. You cannot resign, actually, from it. You can neglect it. But the absolute consequences, if at all you do.
I understand that marriages are supposed to have a strong spiritual basis. And I want to ask this from, I want to say contemporary point of view, that are all romantic relationships spiritual by nature?
No. Directly or indirectly, somewhere indirectly. Because if you look at the issue of just love, you can't help yourself loving somebody else. You don't choose to love someone. The power and the spirit of that person speaks to your spirit. So you cannot, in an African sense, in an African culture, you cannot live without spirit. Spirit guides you whatever way you are at. Sometimes you are walking. Along the way, and you think of somebody, and they phone you. Now, let's go this way. In an African sense, when a person dies, what do you do to them?
You mean their body?
Yeah. Ngesixhosa sithi, ngesiZulu siyangcwaba. Siyokusiyakulahla, siyakhweza, siyakufihla, siyakutshala. What does that tell you about African culture? The person ulahla umuntu onjani? If you are a rapist and a murderer in African culture, when you die, you don't go through the door. You don't go through the window. We have got to break a wall. You have lived an unnatural life. You have got to leave the wall and you go there. Do you think the person like that, or lahliwe, can come back and be an ancestor? You can't. When you get there to the land of the ancestor says, you are messed up. You killed people, you raped people, you killed children, and here you are. Your family has not followed their own culture. Therefore, we are sending your spirit back to your family. Then we say, hey, you are being sent back there, that you must practice your culture and correct yourself and cleanse yourself.
So a person who lived negatively can be sent back to correct their way.
Yeah, be sent back to the family to be corrected. And then the other people, the one who's been drunk all the time, who's been an embarrassment, the one who's been an example, good and generous, I besqueza ubani, besyonyusa ubani, put them high for people to see, to see them. All of these languages, the way in which we do when we actually bury somebody, it is all linked actually into the culture. That's why you've got the concept of a wounded healer. A guy was a murderer, whose spirit is being sent back. And once that person, the spirit is sent back, sometimes it could be a spirit of a man possessing a woman. But that woman is more fiercer than men. It is a woman because it's possessed, you know, by that spirit. We call those a wounded thing, because that person then will be the person who will be a sangoma, who will be able to cure and help people who are murderers, who are like him.
But then doesn't that burden the person who's the vessel, as it were?
Yeah, you know what? When God had the problems in heaven with so many demons, he sent them on earth, and it altered the shape of an elephant. It altered the shape of a giraffe. God said, no, what can I do? God sent it to the pigs. The pigs were able to deal with those demons.
By jumping in the water.
With the water. So in other words, whoever is being sent back, if you are being possessed, you know, by it, they never send you to somebody who's weak, who cannot be able to handle it.
So then why are so many young initiates going through so much trauma? Because sometimes it's made to seem like they are the ones who are weak.
No, no, but it depends. It depends what you call a trauma, because trauma is a very highly troubled in the spiritual space. Mm-hmm. So they have to be in there because they are dealing with the world of the spirits, mm-hmm. and the spirits are going to confuse them a little bit, particularly when they even came from the townships or from what have you. Mm-hmm. But in the end, they come up and become firmer and stronger, mm-hmm. and more embedded, mm-hmm. In their sense of self becomes far much more important. And also, an African says that I'm a sangom, but I'm not a sangom, but pulamatab. I cure through my art. Mm-hmm. Other people become sangom by teaching. Do you know that? Mm-hmm. That's how African culture is a culture generally. It's an empowering of societies, empowering of individuals, and empowering of communities, of guiding communities and individuals through their traumas, through their challenges, through whatever desires they seek to mm-hmm. achieve.
So in your particular instance, your spiritual gift merged with your creative gift.
Yeah, poetry, painting, sculpture.
Yes, because, and the reason I'm asking this is because some people feel as if their spiritual gift clashes with what they believe is what they are here for, because people will say that I was initiated and then I went whereas before I was a whatever, I worked for this company, I was an accountant, I was this, and now I'm sitting, and then comes the depression and the loss of purpose, because it seems like what we generally see is that spirituality or is herded towards sitting in Dumbini and Upulabantu the whole day.
No. I mean, if professionally you choose to be, you may have a spirit yourself, right? Is there anybody in your family, your grandparents, on your mother and your father's side, that was a healer?
Not that I know of.
Check.
No, the reason I know who was, and I know who was supposed to be, but and this is what I found out on my own, but in terms of what the family says, there was no one. You see, I've been fortunate that I was able to find.
How do I know that? I just told you that I know that somebody was in there up in it, and they rejected that healer. It tells. Ask these guys in here. People come in here. We just tell these people's history. When they ask, how do you know? I don't know how I know. Mm-hmm. The topic we are talking about is a very, 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 very important thing. The issue of of culture. I don't know if you have read Wade Noble's. I'll send you some way it defines culture from a cosmological, from an axiological, from an ontological, where the essence of things are. Now, what happens is that if, say, you, Vuzumuzi, you've got a white friend and you are close, you go Kruger National Park together to see animals, and when you are there, you are both bitten by mosquitoes. And then you both get malaria. You both go to the same doctor, and the doctor cures you. And once the doctor is cured, a white person is cured, what is he going to do? Going to go back to work. What is Vusibus going to do? He's going to say, who sent the bloody mosquito? For in African culture, the law of causality is central to everything that it is. It is not an accident that civilization and life started here in here in Africa. People moved away from here and over. Lot of information now that is really coming up about Africa is, you know, that for an instance, you must know about the Dogon.
Yes.
The Dogon, Edo people. The Dogon people knew about the existence of Sirius B.
Yes.
A Sirius B that was invisible to a naked eye. Not even the powerful telescopes had there to get the telescope only 25 years ago. 50 and 100 years ago, hundreds of years ago, it existed there called Potolo. That it circulates around Sirius once in 60 years.
And they have their ceremony every 60 years.
Yeah, the Sikwi.
Yeah.
The Sikwi, that ceremony takes place.
I've always
once
wondered,
in 60 years.
How do you keep, and you see now, this goes to the heart of what I'm trying to get at. They have a ceremony that happens once every 60 years, right? People die, people are born, people die in 60 years, right? Very few people actually witness that ceremony twice in their lives, you know? So then I'm trying to, the whole point of what I'm talking about is that how is culture kept alive over such vast distances or vast periods of time? And in your case, distance, physical distances from where it comes
from the seed of my being, from the seed of your being. Yeah, it's because it is encrypted. The culture is an encryption of a belief systems, you know, in you. At least you helped me. I never even thought of it that way until now. It's encrypted. That's what I was saying when I'm in exile. I remain an African. Right. What makes African Americans, just look at them, just all of them, India, all the professors there, they are the people who are more into African culture and understand it far much more than the people who are actually in the culture in itself, you know, because they said we have been brought in here on false things, we are resisting this, we are something else. It is that culture that kept them. What is it that kept, created the Maroons? Those people, as soon as they landed up in America or in England as slaves, they rebelled against their own masters and went over to the jungles and established their own places in there and spent most of their time rescuing other people that you call, which you call the Maroons. Carrying that culture. They had hair like you, like this. And when the people were being captured, then the people said, yeah, we don't know whether you are going to be captured or anything. If you are captured, how are you going to survive? Then people will collect a lot of seeds of healing stuff that they put into their hair. So that wherever they're just going to be, if they just get these things, then they are going to plant these things and they are going to be in touch.
So that's how some medicinal African medicine arrived in other continents.
Exactly.
Through the hair.
Through the hair. Talking about the hair, in India, the Sikhs don't cut their hair.
Yes.
The Jews don't cut their hair. Many cultures don't cut their hair. It's only black people who cut their hair because apartheid cut the hair. The Rastas, we had a lot of Rastas here. The Sayoni, that were there. They used to have long hair and carrying sculptures of sticks at the back as part of it. You know that song? Sontole Zayoni, Sontola Makwala, Wage Wai Buddha Pindota, Ikonza, Ipetindu. You don't eat it. So the transference of the seeds of what you eat. Now, 7 days ago, a week ago, on Thursday, last Thursday, I went with my wife on a 7.5 hour rock climbing hike in the Mahalis.
In your young age.
Mahalis, yeah, because turning 81, and that's what it is. And people are saying, I just tweeted that within an hour, there were over 300 kind of responses. People say, 81, 7.5, rock climbing, What is it? And yet, up in culture, it is. Just look at Credo living up to a 100 and still be able to say, hey, dude, I'm celebrating my 97th year, but I would like you, you know, to be the one who is going to, you know, preside over me, because it is your spirit that I relate to.
What are your thoughts on Credo?
When you read Credo's books, Credo will tell you that we as African people come from the island, from the planet of the red dog. Just like the Dogon, right? Credo knew things. You know, I tell you, Credo knew things. When you ask him, he'll tell, I don't know how I know. I've been trained by this, but these things just exist. For instance, traditionally in the villages in the Eastern Cape, can you just build a house and put the door to face east or north? Normally, where do the doors face? And when you die and you are in your coffin, do you go with your head or do you go with your foot first? Do you see? How this abarondavul that people do about standards, they are always done in a circle. Like crawl down in the circle, in the same way as the universe is, the planets, the way it is, everything that we do is planned according to. It's built in a form of a constellation. That's why then, because the door must face the Pleiades, the constellation of stars, the Pleiades, what do we call it in Zulu? Isilimela. Why do you call this Limela? Because when it becomes visible, then you know it is time now that I can start to plant. Everything is linked to the heavenly bodies. Credo got that and grabbed that. Mazizi will learn and grab that. All spiritual, great African people will just take you there. Because there are ways of knowing without knowing how you know. But the knowledge is valid.
But now we're westernized. We want proof. We want it to be tested.
Yeah, but that test, those tests can be done. Which one of this guy was my manager here. I was just shocked one day. We were driving with him in a car. We saw a group of people coming. And there's a woman walking in front, like they're all this group of healers, moving and coming. I said, Jonathan, let me stop the car. There's something going on there. He's used to me. So I stop, and as I stop the car, the others come out of the car. The woman who is in front, dressed in the healer's things, moves away from this group of nine they were with, turns towards me, kneels in front of me, says, Tamako. I don't know her. She doesn't know me. The Kobela there says, who is this person you are kneeling to? And the woman says, I'm not kneeling to him, I'm kneeling to his spirit. It is his spirit that has invited me. I get a feeling that the spirit wants to tell me something. I said, yes, the spirit wants to tell you something. I said, you went for initiation to us. You ran away from your Kobela. You went to a second Kobela. You ran away from the second Kobela. That Kobela you have there is a third Kobela. The Kobela says, who are you? Where are you from? Eh? This thing happens in Willowvale. I said, no, I live in Johannesburg. I am just passing through here, but That's what my ancestors and my culture told me. That's what I was able to read to this person. How that happened, I know not. So that's why your interest in this thing, it is because, as I said, someone up on you was supposed to pursue these things practically, and they opted out. Their spirit has gone over into you. We have to dig into these things far deeper than just simply trying to make a living or make a reputation. Let it be an article of faith.
What would happen? And part of the reason I'm asking, the whole point of this episode, is that we have a general understanding that we're gradually losing our culture.
Yeah.
Right. As a generation. And I think the rate is exponential. Like, it's getting the depredation is getting faster and faster. And
is that true? With how many young women, overwhelming mushrooming of young women from journalists in ENCA and all of these things that are going for Twasa.
Why is that?
It is because people realize that our culture is kind of diminishing. The ancestors are rearming, the people. How many, I tell you, just this week alone, I was phoned and consulted by 7 people I just do not know, who are saying we are having a problem with the spirit. And I am going to Twasa. Can I come and talk to you? While we are saying it is disappearing, the avalanche, everybody else, I think you have seen it even in the media and anywhere else, that people say, is it a fashion? Other people say, is it a fashion? But ultimately, you find that it is not a fashion. The people are genuinely called. They may not go and sit and numb it. They'll still be reading the news and doing anything, but right inside, themselves, wherever they are, where they meet other people, they exude that kind of a spirit and help the spirit. So you can undergo Twasa, not because you'll become a sangoma or you want to be a sangoma. Sometimes you have to go up in Twasa to acknowledge the ancestors. That is in it. Now, let me ask you a question. To you, what's the difference between Idlozi and Thongo?
Idlozi and Thongo. Okay, here's my understanding. Amathongo are, I think in Christianity, they would call them the council, the divine council, right? This is my personal understanding of this, right? The divine council are, I can almost say, the eternal beings. You have a strange face.
Yeah, I'm listening.
Right. So this is my understanding. Amathongo are the council of spirits that are eternal. I'm not sure if they ever lived or not, whether they lived on earth or not, or if they are eternal beings of that nature. They've perpetually been in spirit. And what I understand is that they then choose amongst your lineage who will be your guide. And then that guide then becomes Idlozi. And Idlozi would be from, generally speaking, would be from your bloodline.
Someone who lived and died.
Someone who lived and died, yes.
So right, Idlozi is someone who lived and died and got canonized to become Idlozi.
Yes, right. Canonized by Amathongo. This is my understanding. Understand. Yes.
In my knowledge, it was somebody who lives and dies and gets canonized, right? On the other hand, the Thongo is your spiritual self. You are living your life physically here. you have your own itogo, your spiritual self, which the Catholics call a guardian angel. That's really what it is. And that's where then the issue of dreams, the interpretation of dreams, itongo comes to you also in the form of a dream that you have to unravel to, you know, to kind of to guide you. Many of Izangoma, they conflate the two. They think Idlozi and they are interchangeable. I had to address 750 THO women because on television I made my version of Idlozi the Thongo. And they said, no, professor. I said to Pepsi, she just died. I said, call your meeting in here. The city gave us a hall. There were so many. I said, I'm going to face them because I believe in what I believe in. And I'm going to say it is going to be my ancestors against the rest of those hundreds of those people. I know what I'm talking about. And I went in there and explained, you know, to them. Now, itongo is your spiritual self. When you are here.
Is that what they call your soul?
Yes, more than the soul. And now, uma ulele ulalani. Ulala ubuthongo. Language tells you. Ulala ubuthongo. Because the talk like, will come to you in a form of dreams.
Mm-hmm.
From the spirit world.
Ubuthongo.
Yeah. From the spirit world to you. You are a physical representation of your spiritual self.
So in closing, what is it that you would want my generation to know about culture?
Oh, have you ever heard of Saint Augustine?
I've heard of the name.
There is an Augustinian order. They Saint Augustine. It is from Saint Augustine the word know thyself came from.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Saint Augustine? Black man saint in Europe.
Mm.
It's not surprising that he says know thyself, because these people don't know you. And if you don't know yourself, then you are going to be taken. That's what colonialism do. You unknow yourself. Yeah? My name is Petros. My name is Petros. Pitika, I had to rescue it from somewhere else. Probably you are Jeremiah or Joseph, a name that you're actually hiding, identified by a sound that is even alien to your own culture. Well, I don't know.
Okay. All right. If I asked you which country has seen the largest number of people dying from starvation, you will probably imagine it to be some drought-stricken country somewhere in the middle of Africa. Nope, that's not the case. Between 1959 and 1961, around 55 million people died of starvation in China. 55 million. That's almost the entire population of South Africa today, dying of hunger. Perhaps the most devastating part of this is that this was not just a result of droughts and crop infestations or floods. It was actually a result of government policies. In 1958, Chairman Mao launched what was called the Great Leap Forward. It was an ambitious campaign to turn the country into a communist society. What this actually translated into was that the government took ownership of every kilometer of land in the country, turning it into a state-owned entity. By the 70s, 80% of the population of China worked on government-owned farms. No citizen was allowed to own anything. The policies that were imposed were too harsh on the people and on the land. Eventually, the entire agricultural system collapsed. In the wake of this disaster, Chairman Mao launched yet another campaign, one that would eventually break China at its very soul. In 1976, the Chinese Cultural Revolution began. A big part of this revolution was getting rid of what had come to be called the old fours. Well, the old fours were 1. Old ideas, old culture, old habits, and old customs. These, it was said, had poisoned the minds of the Chinese people for thousands of years, and all of them had to be eradicated from all of society. And in their place, it was going to be basically the government and government policy. As disastrous as these campaigns were, it was actually Chairman Mao's successor, Deng Xiaoping, who resurrected China. He did this in part by supporting the one-child policy and revamped the entire education system with a focus on science and technology. This then set the country on a course to become the industrial powerhouse that we know it as today. In general, you can describe Chinese culture as one of industrial efficiency. But what does that mean for the people? Well, China has a social credit score. It's kind of like our credit score for money, but then it measures how good you are as a citizen according to the government. Not gods, not morality, not culture, but according to the government. You can get punished for offending the government, and there are systems of repentance if you do. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. And what about spirituality? Well, remember the Nanhua temple that I mentioned in the opening scene? Well, the land on which it was built, it was donated to the Chinese government by the local council in exchange for economic opportunities. You can make of that what you will. The point of the Chinese example, as extreme as it may be, is to try to illustrate how malleable culture actually is. China went from devastating poverty to economic powerhouse in one single lifetime. You may ask then, at what cost? Well, traditional culture was replaced by industrial efficiency. Individuals simply became cogs in the economic machine. Customs were replaced with a culture of being commended for being willing to die at the machine to ensure that everything is made in China. Culture is a process of creating meaning out of concepts in our life experiences and assigning those meanings some kind of value. Here's an example. I am a human being. That is a biological concept. Also, I am a man, which is a social meaning to that concept. Also, I am a provider. This is a cultural value added to that meaning. In that example, you can already see where the constants are and where the variables are. For one thing, being human is a biological concept that will never change. I will never not be a human being. But at the same time, being a man in 2021 needs to be qualified. I am a cis heterosexual man. That's because our understanding of gender classifications is broadening and will therefore change over time, albeit slowly. Being a provider, on the other hand, as things stand today, is very, very debatable. Our socioeconomics are such that many men actually can't afford to be the provider because many, many men don't have jobs. On the other hand, many women are learning how to be providers for themselves and their children if you look at the statistics. So that means that whether we like it or not, we are going to have to look at the value system and how it evaluates the meaning of men and women and their subsequent roles that they play in our society and how we assign value to those roles. The resurgence of African spiritualists and healers in our generation, I think, offers a crucial opportunity to recreate a spiritual value system that will in turn become a culture that we can hand over to the coming generations. Using the same example as above, here's another one. Our ancestors exist. That is an unchanging constant. Our ancestors are angry. This is a perceived constant. I need to slaughter a cow to appease my ancestors. This is a variable. Let me break it down. The anger of our ancestors or their ill health is something that we are facing as a generation, but it is not something that is true for everyone, nor is it something that is going to last forever. It is extremely circumstantial based on our history. The slaughter of a cow to appease the ancestors is something that will always be in change. Our socioeconomics are such that we don't always have the money to buy a cow. Our yards are small and we live in flats and we live in townhouses. So the logistics of slaughtering an entire cow are extremely challenging for most people. So we have resorted to slaughtering goats and chickens. It could very well be that one day even slaughtering a goat is going to have logistical challenges too. So in this scenario, what is the concept that we are trying to give meaning to and what value are we assigning to that meaning? For one thing, the concept is that we are intrinsically connected to our ancestors across generations and across realms. The meaning that we are trying to inculcate in that is that cultivating a bond with them makes us stronger across generations and across realms as well. So then the value in slaughtering becomes apparent, and an understanding of honoring the death of an animal as a channel of communion also becomes apparent. At that point, the means of appeasing the ancestors should fit whatever a person can financially and logistically afford to. And that is the value system that we can leave for coming generations. If we lose our culture, we basically lose our capacity to create meaning in our collective lives and give those meanings value. The reality is that nature does not allow for a vacuum. There can be no empty space. There is no such thing as I don't have a culture. If it is not yours, then it is going to be someone else's. And a value system benefits only those who created it. So what will happen if we lose our culture? If we refuse to adapt to our changing circumstances and make sure that it still reflects who we are and affirms our values, then it will be replaced by something else. Something that we will have no control over. And something that will have all the control over us. My name is Vusum Zinglandi. Thank you so very much for joining me on yet another episode of The Journey Kwantu. And thank you so much to everyone who gives me feedback. I sincerely and humbly appreciate it. It means a lot to me. I wish you light, I wish you courage, and I wish you all the very best on your journey. Makwande.